This is Paul Leek, interviewed by Chris Alden-Lee on the 20th of November, 2013. Paul Leek, Part 1.
My name is Paul Hilton Leek, and I was born in Sheffield, England.
When was that?
25th of July, 1937.
So how old are you now, Paul?
76.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
My father was a great guy. He was always proud of the fact that he was working class. Whereas looking back at it, he wasn't really. He would have loved to be educated except for the fact that he had to leave school when he was 10 because of family circumstances. But he was self-educated. Although he was a working guy, he was this peculiar system that they have in Sheffield. He was a little mester, which meant that he was kind of freelance working in a company. It's a weird and wonderful system. But he claimed he was working class. He owned his own house. At one point, he owned two houses. He owned a car. So by any measure, he was basically middle class at the very least. But
What was his career? What did he do?
He was he was referred to as an agricultural fitter. And what he did was he made parts for agricultural machines. I believe during the war, which he fortuitously missed, shall we say. He missed the First World War because he was too young. The Second World War, he came along, and what happened was it started in 1939, and I believe story is that when it started, when it got to be 1940-odd and things started to get a little tough, he went round to the recruiting office and offered his services. And the recruiting sergeant looked at him and said, "Where do you work?" And he says, "Spafford." And he says, "What do you do?" And my dad says, I'm a fitter. And the guy said, "Look," he says, "you're better off making stuff to throw at the buggers than being over there trying to shoot at them." which was almost certainly true.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then by this time he was 41, 42 anyway. So he said, "You know, too old anyway, mate. So go back and get to work." So he probably made a fair amount of money. He always owned his own house. You know, I don't think he ever had a mortgage, but even when he started out, but he always owned his own house. So.
What was his name?
Harold Leek.
And your mum?
Hmm?
Your mum?
My mother was Nora Leek. They were both from Sheffield, and my mother's father, my grandfather, he was a barber, a hairdresser, although he always referred to himself as a businessman.
So, what about your education, Paul?
Well, I went to the usual thing about grammar school, and then I went to Liverpool University and got a bachelor's degree in physics.
Why were you attracted to physics? Well, first of all, were you the first of your family to go to university?
Yeah, yeah.
And why choose physics?
I was very interested in what was known nowadays as a nerd. I was the guy who, you know, I had very little interest in girls. Girls were too complicated for me, and the social relationships were too complicated. So I was a sort of kid. I was always an awkward kid. I was always the awkward guy. I went to grammar school, which surprised the hell out of everybody because nobody thought, or at least my teachers were surprised that I would actually get into grammar school. And I did reasonably well until, I don't know, I was 15. And we got up to the O level, we were getting towards the O level, and I got into some trouble. And the headmaster took me into his office and he said, "You know, what's happening? What's happening, you see?" And I said, "Well, you know, you're making me take Latin and I hate Latin. You took away my two best subjects, which geography and woodwork, you see?" So he said, "Okay, you got them back." So I did 6 months of geography and woodwork and got no level in both of them, just like that. I went from the bottom of the top to the top of the class, just like that. Mm-hmm. So... you know, if I like doing something, I do well at it.
So where did physics come in?
Physics came in because, well, physics and maths and chemistry were the sort of things that I really liked because they were concrete, you know. I could learn something and do some, you know, learn something. I could read about it, learn something, do some experiments, and that was it. You know, I knew what was going to happen. And I like to be able to work out things, consequences, you know. Someone will show me something and I have to work out, like a magic trick. You do a magic trick, I'll work out how the hell you're going to do it. And that's the way I am, you see. Now, when it came to getting ready to go to university, I was thinking about it and I was torn between physics and engineering. When I was at school, you know, in the sixth form, I did physics, chemistry, and double maths. That's maths and pure and applied maths, as they call it, double maths. And I was very good at all of those. And I was kind of deciding whether to go physics or engineering. I was kind of torn towards engineering because although I'm kind of interested in physics, I'm not really a theoretical physicist. You know, the Big Bang is a great idea, but all these ideas they have about string theory, I'm not really interested in. Mm. You know, as far as I'm concerned, they're a religion. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, I mean, there are people who are interested, but I may be a nerd, but I ain't quite that much of a nerd.
So are you saying you like things where there's one correct answer?
Well, where I can work out an answer, yes. Mm. Well, I like things where I can establish a definite cause and a definite effect. You know, personal relationships are much more difficult. You know, you can think that so and so obviously should do such and such, and damn way they don't. They do something completely different, or for other reasons. But anyway, I liked the concrete results and the concrete this, that, and the other. So, like I say, I was thinking about either physics or engineering, but the engineering, I came to the conclusion, was more of a fixed answer. In other words, you've got a question here, you've got a fixed answer. I did like to have a bit of flexibility, plus the fact that engineering was, okay, you did either electrical engineering or you did mechanical engineering, or I was really interested in electronics. Mm-hmm. But it didn't exist then, see? So it was called radio and whatever, but electronics didn't exist. So, okay. So anyway, I thought, okay, physics, you see, because the physics, I mean, I do a lot of stuff, and I get interested in a lot of stuff. And, you know, and I can feel I can do a lot of stuff, a lot of different stuff, and I do. You know, for instance, you know, my present job, I'm designing linear accelerators, and I do a lot of electronics and a lot of, you know, electronic work and stuff like that. A few years ago, we had a problem, and I had to do some design to verify that a piece of building was okay and the welding was okay. And I just opened my old book up and say, okay, you know, look, I got the formula here. I got the, okay, it's safe. So, you know, I'm a Renaissance man. I do everything, and as they say, you do everything. You do everything well, but you do everything, but you don't do everything perfectly. Okay. Oh, all right. So
that was that impulse.
That was my impulse. You know, I really liked physics. You know, because you know you can you know in those days you know I was okay, physics is this, that, and that. I realized later on that, you know, physics is just a blooming mess. You know, you've got all sorts of stuff, because you've got optics, you've got electrics, you've got mechanics, you know, all these different aspects are completely different, but at the same time, you know, that allows you to do all sorts of stuff and know all sorts of stuff and use all sorts of stuff.
So it's a real conglomerate, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a mess.
But, well, okay. Your word, not mine. Where did the interest in the Antarctic spring from then?
It's like, kind of like this. When I was at college, you know, I went to college and I was doing all this stuff, you see, and I kind of started to move away from, you know, being sort of, you know, fixated on, I guess what it amounts to is partly the fact that, you know, when you go to college, you know, you're in high school or grammar school, what happens is that, you know, you're top of the school, and boy, these are the blooming genius, you see. And you go to college and you meet a bunch of guys or girls. In my days, it was mainly guys. And they're all blooming geniuses, you see. And you get to the stage where, well, I'm not the sort of guy who competes on anything, see. So I thought, okay, that's fine, you see. And I did a lot of stuff there. And then I got more interested in outdoor work. Well, I was already quite interested in going outdoors and, you know, backpacking and rock climbing and all this sort of stuff. So I was always interested in that sort of stuff, and I got more interested when I was at college. And so when I finished, when I got my degree, I said, okay. When I got my degree, as I went from the graduation ceremony, I says to me, Dad, okay, I'll see you, and went up the Lake District for a couple of weeks rock climbing. So I was interested in the outdoors and, you know, mountaineering and all that sort of stuff.
Had you read about the heroes, the Antarctic heroes?
I had to a certain extent, but only vaguely. I hadn't been focused on the Antarctic particularly.
You didn't have a yearning to go then?
I hadn't a desperate yearning to go there. No, I hadn't a desperate yearning to go anywhere. I was kind of... I never had a career path. Mm. I never worked on having a career path. It was always a case of, okay, play it by ear. You see? Mm-hmm. Which has worked out very well. But, okay, play it by ear. So what it amounts to is that I've graduated from university, and now, between you and me, I was lucky that I did it in those days, because, you know, I got scholarships, so that I got more than enough money from Derbyshire County Council. You know, my parents didn't have to pay a dime, and I didn't have to take out any loans. That was in these are the glory days of education, which I think we're supremely better than what we got nowadays. But anyway, whatever you guys have got is... I had a couple of bucks stored away, saved. And anyway, I went for climbing for a couple of weeks up in the Lake District, and then got back. And I thought, well, okay, got to get a job. Oh, and there was another big factor, you see? National service.
Right.
You see?
To be avoided?
Well, it wasn't particularly to be avoided. It was a case of, you know, national service was something you had to think about, you see. Thinking back on it, it was really a paper tiger, shall we say, because looking back on it, there was any number of jobs that I could have got, and I would have got it deferred then. Because what it amounts to is that I'd reached the stage, I'm not sure about the exact chronology, but the year that I graduated was the year they quit national service. After that, they were mopping up. So I was going to be mopped up, you see. And I knew, later on, I knew lots of guys who had basically got jobs with companies, especially with electronics or radio. What the hell do they call it? Radio, whatever it is. They didn't call it electronic. Electronics was kind of not quite invented as a word in those days. Anyway, it's kind of... I got my favourite magazine, which was Wireless World. I was looking through there, and I saw this advert for FIDS, you see. I thought, well, that sounds kind of interesting. You know, so I sent them a letter saying, okay, I'm interested. And they sent me a telegram back saying, okay, come down. So I went down to London, walked in the office, and they said, who are you? I said, I'm Paul Leek. They said, oh, we thought you weren't coming. We got a telegram saying you weren't coming. I said, well, I'm here. So they said, well, okay, we'll interview you, you see. So anyway, I said, you know, what it amounts to is that the job I saw advertised was radio operator, you see. I said, well, you know, I got my CDE and guilds in radio engineering, and I can get my Morse up if you want to. I was a little bit of interest in amateur radio, so they said, okay. And then they turned around and said, well, you know, what we want is an ionospherist. I says, okay, what's that? You see, so, so they explained what it was, and they said, you know, we don't need any more radio mechanics at the moment, but we do need ionospherists, and we do need people who've got degrees. See, we, you know, basically, you know, if you've got a degree, well, then we welcome you with open arms. Didn't say for anything, but that was the implication. So I said, okay, that's good. And then he turned around and said, okay, fill the form in. He said, oh, you've got a bit of a problem. I said, what's that? He said, well, you ain't 21. I said, well, I'll be 21 in a couple of weeks. Oh, okay. So I went back and had a huddle and he said, okay, we've decided that if you're 21 when you get on the ship, then you're okay. So I thought, okay, that's fine. So then they turned around and said, well, okay, you know, we'll sign you on. That was the other funny thing. They said, you sign you on, but you only get, I think it was £400 a year. I can't remember if it was 400 or £420 a year. And I thought, oh, blimey. I'd read all about some of these expeditions, and I thought, oh, I actually get paid. Mm. Oh, this is good.
Was there any extra remuneration because you were a graduate?
No, they said that. They said, well, you know, you don't get anything because you've got a degree. We're working on that. Okay, that's good. Work on it. I thought, I'm glad I'm getting £400, you know. And then they turned around and said, you sign you on for this, and you can give your family some money, you see. And I said, well, okay, I'll give them £10 a month, you see. And they said, wait a minute. You know, that's going to cut into your. I said, okay, I tell you what, give them £5 a month. I think it was £5 a month. I said, okay, give that to me folks, you see, so that's fine. And they said, okay, you've got to go to...
Well, they were signing you up to do ionospherics, and you knew nothing about ionospherics, or did he know something and you weren't telling them?
Well, I'm a physicist. I know a little bit about... I'm a physicist and also... I'd been interested in amateur radio. So, you know, I knew what the ionosphere was. I knew quite a bit about it. You know,
but you still had to be trained.
Pardon?
You still had to be trained.
I still had to be trained because I didn't know anything in details. You know, I didn't know anything about these, A layers, F layers. You know, they weren't gibberish to me, but, you know, I had some vague knowledge of them, you see. So, anyway, they said, you know, and not only that, but you've got to be trained in the in the machine that they were using, the ionoson, you see. We had to know how to fix the darn thing, you see. But I did have a lot of, quite a lot of knowledge and background in what is now called electronics. You know, tubes and all that sort of stuff. Because I'd been, you know, when I was a lad, I'd been taking radios apart and, going down the dump and picking up what bits I could and kind of working out how to put them together and getting some pretty healthy electric shocks at times. So I knew which end of a soldering iron gets hot, let's put it that way. So, I knew something about it.
In the interview, do you... If they couldn't ask you questions about ionospherics because you didn't know much, what did they ask you about? Were they kind of sussing you out, do you think?
Well, I don't really know, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I often think about that because, you know, they had a pretty tough job because, you know, thinking on about it, what have you got? You end up with a situation where you've got five guys stuck together in a very difficult situation. Mm. And I hadn't thought, like I say, I just went along. I didn't have any career prospects. I didn't have any career ideas. I thought, okay, here we go. What are we going to do next? Okay, this looks good. Let's have a go at it. And then I sort of read a little bit more about it and looked around and what they got. And I thought, oh, blimey, there's all those bloody mountains down there. Boy, it looks great, doesn't it? Eh? Oh, boy. I was ready to climb the lot, mate, no problem. Mm-hmm. So, it didn't occur to me anything about it, but I'm sure, well, let me say, they should have been in a position where they were working out, how you work on with interpersonal relationships, mm-hmm. because it was very important. But, you know, I don't really know. I, to be honest with you, I don't quite remember exactly what it was.
But you were sent off for training, first of all, in Slough?
Yeah, they said, OK, you've got to go down to Slough for, I think it was a couple of weeks down there, at the radio research station there. And then they sent me off to Inverness for, I was there about a couple of months, I think. And that, I was introduced to a whole world that I didn't know about and my parents had no concept of. And that was, you know, okay, you're going somewhere and the company's paying. Okay, you need a passport, the company's paying. You know, oh, you need this, company's paying. That's, you know, it's a whole new, a complete new world that I knew nothing about and my parents had no knowledge of either. So anyway, I went down to Slough for, I think it was a couple of weeks, and they said, okay, we've got another guy and he's already up in Inverness. So then I went up to Inverness and, you know, basically we were basically learning how to do the stuff, which wasn't all that tough, and then learning about the ion sonde itself, how it worked and all the electronics and all that stuff, which I didn't find very challenging at all either. So as far as I was concerned, this was all real, real good stuff. And, you know, you get to up to Inverness and you can go for long walks and they had bikes, you know.
The odd mountain.
Huh?
The odd mountain.
They got, yeah, we travelled around on the bikes and, well, it was kind of cute. I liked that. And, of course, you know, I also was starting to get the concept that, you know, someone is paying me, you know. which was an interesting concept to me.
How did you adjust to the idea of doing ionospherics? How did you get on with it? Did it come naturally?
It came naturally. As far as I was concerned, there wasn't really a lot. There wasn't a lot to it. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, you're in university and you're learning a lot of stuff. There's a lot of, you know, you get crammed with a lot of stuff as you're going along. But this was, you know, okay, you learn this. And it's not as if you're going to learn this and then you're going to learn something completely different. You learn this and this is what you're going to be doing for the next 2 years. So it becomes easier to do because, you know, you're learning it in depth. But it's not something that I didn't find it to be too difficult. Let me put it that way. Mm. It was quite easy for me. So,
do you remember who taught you?
Huh?
Do you remember who taught you?
To be honest with you, I don't. No. Okay. Well, I mean, most of the sort of, shall we say, heavy duty stuff going through the circuits and going through the different parts of the ionosonde, they'd done in Slough. I mean, I think the idea was, you know, we went up to Inverness to basically keep us online. I don't know. It was, you know, we got these guys ready to go down and that was it.
Was it not rather like running an ionospheric station in Inverness? You were, as it was like a dummy run for the Antarctic?
It was exactly the same machine. It was exactly the same way. They're doing exactly the same work there. Right. You know, between you and me, we were not doing ionosonic research. It was basically just measurements. Mm. We were measuring the ionosphere. And in those days, the ionosphere was very important because it was the basis of worldwide communication. You know, they didn't got cables, they hadn't got internet, they hadn't got satellites. So, you know, anything that got transmitted from London to Australia or wherever, they went through the ionosphere. Mm. And so you had to know what was happening and, you know, what the parameters were. Okay, this time of day you can't transmit to them because the ionosphere is closely controlled by the sun and the seasons. So, you know, at night the ionosphere gets much smaller, shall we say. Mm. In the winter it gets much smaller. And this is one of the advantages because where we were, you have the solar effects. The other effect is the magnetic poles, which we didn't have. That was around the other side of the Antarctic. So we were able to, in a position where you could sort out the two effects. Not that we were doing that. We were just doing the measurements. Somebody else was doing the whatever was required. Although we did end up with several research projects, but we were basically just collecting data.
Like recording the weather.
It was like recording the weather, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was like recording the weather, yes.
So, just going back to Inverness then, Was there a sense that you had to pass that part of the process to be sure to be going south? Was it a test?
No. As far as I'm aware, there was never any question about going south. Okay.
What did your parents make of this idea of our Paul going to the Antarctic?
My mother was... my mother was not in favour of it. I think my father was one of these guys who... He was a proper Yorkshireman. He didn't say a whole hell of a lot. He thought a hell of a lot, but he didn't say a whole hell of a lot. And I think he was probably quite happy about it. My mother, on the other hand, was not. But, of course, I was aided by National Service. You see, it's a case of either he goes there or he may end up in Cyprus getting shot at. Okay, they send the Antarctic
is safer.
Yeah. And I do remember that my mother said to me, what it amounts to is that about 2 months after I'd sailed from Southampton, she got a letter from the government saying, okay, report to Catterick at such and such and such and such. And she wrote back to him and said, I'm sorry, mate, you've got to put a bigger stamp on it. So,
how big a factor in your mind was avoiding National Service? Was it a tilting factor?
No, it was no factor at all. Let me put it this way: I wasn't real. Like I say, I just loafed along through life at that point. I mean, I could have really pursued things by, you know, joining the OTC, the Officers Training Club at Liverpool and stuff like that. But I couldn't be bothered. I just didn't bother about it. I was the sort of guy who had gone in, I probably have gone into the army and they had turned around and said, okay, you know, a couple of weeks square bashing, you know, you've got a degree, so you're offered material. And, you know, I'd probably done okay in the army. I wouldn't have made any great waves about it. They may have turned around and said, boy, you don't tie your boots up right, but... you know, they would have put me on some, you know, fixing radars and all that. So I'd have been in the radar mechanic, what's it, because they just said, boy, this is what you can do.
How did you get south?
What do you mean, how did I get south?
What mode of transport?
Oh, what, down to the Antarctic? I went on the Shackleton, the RRS Shackleton. I enjoyed that. That was good. We went down. We sailed out of Southampton probably around about this time of year, September, October, something like that. I forget exactly when it was. This is it. I'd never been on a ship before, so that's all good stuff. It was kind of funny actually because if I remember rightly, we started out. And then, I went in the bunk. The next morning I woke up and looked out the porthole and thought, funny, there's land on the wrong side here, guys. we had to go back for something or other. I don't know what it was, but we went back.
They've forgotten something.
Back to Southampton because something had been forgotten or something. I don't know, but there was a... they turned around and went back again, so... Well, that was good. You know, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being on the ship. It was, like I say, it was all... I kind of like new experiences. And incidentally, when I was in Scotland, I met the guy who was going to be accompanying me on the ship and everything. You see, this guy George Lewis. He was older than me, and he'd had experience. He'd had much more experience than I had, and he came from a kind of a middle-class family anyway. But he was a good guy, but I did learn one thing from him, and that is that he was the sort of guy who had a fund of experience. He'd spent several years in Germany, and he had a fund of experiences, a fund of stories, funny stories. And what I discovered was that these funny stories are great the first time around, not too bad the second time around, but, you know... You live on base with some guy and he keeps bringing these damn things up. After a while, you turn around and say, oi, George, I have heard that one before. So I kind of learned, you know, keep it down, guys.
Well, how did you all get on the five of you? Because there were some interesting characters, Alan Cameron, David Price, I've interviewed both those. So how were the social dynamics of that first year?
The social dynamics were okay. I mean, George was the, I wouldn't say he's the odd man out, but he was the guy who was a bit different from the rest. He came from, his family were army, you see. Now, as far as I was concerned, army was army, you see. But I discovered in later life that if you're in the army, well, then, and in point of fact, he came from a family that was army, and he had bucked the trend by joining the Air Force. So, you know, he was, family was that sort of army, you see. And he'd been to a public school. Or a private school, depending on how you look at it. I don't know which one it was, but he'd been to a public school. So he was basically, from our point of view, a different social class. But he fitted in okay. He fitted in, not perfectly, but okay. Alan Cameron was a good lad. He was, you know, he was the base leader. When I was there, he was the base leader. But in point of fact, you know, base leader was, as far as he was concerned, was first among equals, you know. Okay, mm-hmm. He'd turn around and say, okay, we've got all this coal to bring up, you know, that's it. And his idea was, okay, I'm the first guy, okay, you guys come along and follow me. And he didn't turn around and say, okay, you know, it'd be a case of let us bring the coal up and let us would get on with it, you see. And Dave Price, he was an easygoing guy too. I mean, he was
a diesel mechanic, a conduit from Listers.
He was a diesel mechanic, yeah. He's a diesel mechanic, and what it amounts to is that he went down there specifically with the diesels because they got these new Lister diesels, and he was the guy who basically put them in and got them working and all that sort of stuff. And what they wanted to do, their idea was they wanted him to stay there for the second year because he was a diesel. You know, he was a Lister expert, you see. And he kind of, he was a bit of an outside, you know, an outdoor guy, and he wanted to move to, see, what it amounts to is everybody at Port LaCroix, not everybody, doesn't include me, but a lot of people at Port LaCroix, they wanted to go further south because we weren't below the Antarctic Circle. You've got to be below the circle, you know. That's George Lewis, that was a big thing with him, you see. He really wanted to be below the Antarctic Circle. So he applied and he got transferred to Halley Bay. As far as I was concerned, Halley Bay was, it's flat as a blooming pancake, for goodness sake. Where's the bloody mountains? You know, what am I going to climb?
But how did he get on with Dave Price?
I got on very well with Dave Price, yeah. I got on very well with almost, the only one that was, you know, I could get along with George okay. The only one that was a little funny at times was Crockford. Mike Crockford,
and, the radio operator.
He was the radio operator, and I got on okay with him, but sometimes we may get into a bit of an argument about things.
what did you argue about?
Well, he might be. We had a dog there, Peso, and he maybe. I thought he didn't treat the dog quite as well as he ought to. So, he'd tease the dog and stuff like that, and I didn't like that. So, but apart from that, he was okay.
And there's a guy called Jack Tinbergen as well.
Jack Tinbergen, yeah, he was there when I arrived, and he was there for a month or so after I got there, and then he came out. Mm. He was okay. Jack was. He was a big guy. It's like a lot of big guys. He was a big guy, easygoing, and he was. But he came from a scientific family. I know his father was some. I think he was an animal psychologist or something like that, or an animal expert. Let's put it that way. But he was a nice guy.
When you first sailed into the bay at Port LaCroix, Describe to me what you saw. What was the base like, and what was its location like?
Well, the thing is that we'd already visited about five bases, but I was kind of, you know, going down the Neumayer Channel there. It's impressive, you know. You got this bloody great mountain on one side and mountains on the other side, and then you come around and you go into the bay. I thought, boy, this is kind of like heaven here, you know. For somebody who likes mountains, boy, I'm in heaven here. I mean, you know, I thought, and of course, the thing is, you see, that, you know, you get there and it was around about Christmas. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was sort of, you know, middle of December or something like that, maybe a little after that. It was around about Christmas. So, you know, you're around about the solstice. So, I mean, it doesn't matter what time you get in there, it's going to be daylight, for God's sake. You know, you look around and you think, boy, that's bloody grand here, I'll tell thee. I was very impressed, yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it was a beautiful place.
Did you get to climb the mountains?
Yeah, I climbed some of the mountains, yes. I was a little disappointed about some of the mountains. As far as I'm concerned, I always follow my feet. So I wanted to climb the mountains, and Dave Price was, he was interested, but he wasn't too keen. And, you know, the way the schedules worked with the cook and the Gashan, it didn't work out very well. At one point, you know, we got to the stage where I persuaded him, okay, we'll go for a, a camping trip up the glacier. So we went up for a camping trip up the glacier, went up the glacier, put the camp up, tent up. It blew like a you-know-what, mate. It was blowing like a son of a bitch. And he'd even picked up a 50-pound bloody, what's it? You had these boxes of food boxes, of ration boxes, and there's 50-pound ration boxes just took off. So we turned around and went back. And when we got back, George Lewis was sat there and he said, yeah, I recorded 100 knots. So, but what it amounts to is the reason why I say I fell on my feet was because, you know, I got used to it and travelled around in the first year. But the second year, Feds decided that they wanted to hire this guy, John Cunningham. And John Cunningham was, I discovered when they said he was a climber from a notorious climbing club in Scotland. So I thought, oh, this is great. And we did get to do some climbing when he came in. But, you know, what it amounts to is, if you read the books by people like Charcot and people like that, they go, oh, this mountain, oh, that mountain. But we are not in that position, because what it amounts to is that, you know, you always had this idea that if anything happens, you're on your own. Mm. You know, and even though you can be devil about it, you know, you've got four other guys, and it's always at the back of your mind that, you know, you have to be, you know, because, you know, just imagine if, you know, if, well, I mean, it happened. I mean, when I went down there, we picked up, geez, I can't remember his name now. Oh, that's terrible. We picked up this guy. I think we picked up this guy at Signy. And when we got to Hope Bay, him and I, he was interested in climbing. So him and I climbed up the mountain back. I think it's not Mass, Mount Flora, I think it was called. Hmm. We climbed up there. And, you know, I got friendly with him. And we had to drop him off on, Jesus Christ, one of the islands there, before we got to Deception. And he died. He got killed. He went out for a walk with another guy, Russ Thompson. I can't remember the other guy's name, but he went out for a walk with Russ Thompson and... I was always kind of a, you know, like a thought at the back of your mind, that, you know, because what it amounts to is he was walking on the glacier with this other guy, Russ Thompson, and a husky, and the husky lost his footing on the ice, ran into the guy, knocked him off his feet, and he slid down the slope and ended up hitting some rocks with his head, and, you know... Okay, he was dead. Now, whether he was instantly dead or whether they could have rescued him, because the fact of the matter is that Russ Thompson then went back to the base, which probably took him about an hour to get there. So even if they send a rescue team out to him and he'd broken his neck, what the hell are they going to do? I mean, it's really tough. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because I had a lot of interesting, a lot of fun on the way down as well, you see, because, like I said, we climbed that mountain, and then we got to Deception. On the way into Deception, on the way out of that place on Base G, is it King George's Bay, is it, or something? I can't remember. Anyway, on the way out of there, the ship got twanged. I learned a lot about how they go on ship. Because what it amounts to is that the captain decided, or someone decided, that we'd unloaded all the stores. Okay, tomorrow morning we're going to start out. You see? So tomorrow morning comes, and you look, all the bay is busy filling up with bloody ice floes. You see, the wind's changed, and boy, we're getting... So the captain decides, okay, we're going to get out, you see. So I start trying to charge his barge his way out, and ends up getting stuck, and he reverses the ship, and then in reversing the ship, he bends the rudder. So now we can only turn left.
This is the Shackleton, isn't it?
That's the Shackleton, yeah.
How did they solve the problem?
Well, they solved the problem. That was interesting. The dynamics were interesting, you see, because now you've got all the mechanics of the engine room staff are thoroughly pissed, of course. And the captain is saying, well, okay, so we ended up basically being the interlocutor between the captain and the engine room because they didn't want to talk to one another. So we went down and we were talking to I guess the bosun and these other guys, you see. And what they did was they basically unfastened the bolt or whatever it was. They said, okay, go forward. So the thing isn't quite so jammed. And they unfastened all the gearing and basically rearranged everything so that the rudder would, you know, the rudder would run in the right direction, you see. But it took some time and a lot of effort.
And they were doing that from inside the ship?
Inside the ship. So they were doing it from inside the ship. In the meantime, I think the captain was a little concerned. Sometimes you're not entirely sure exactly the dynamics because, you know, you're not talking to these guys. There's two things that happened, I realised later, you see, that first thing is that the captain can be concerned about things, or he can just say he's concerned about something in order to get guys... Captains of ships always like to keep people doing something, you know. People standing around doing nothing, especially in a situation like that, you know, it's... So basically what he amounts to is he decided, okay, we should start collecting a bunch of snow and that because we're short of water. Okay, so we're busy collecting snow. Hey, we get out to walk on the ice floes, which we'd never done before. This is great stuff, you know. We have a stroll around, take photographs and do a bit of work and all this. It was great. And then, like I say, eventually, we about a day or so later, the wind changed and we got out of it. You see? And I realised that, you know, everything in the Antarctic then is... even more dependent on weather than it is anywhere else. You know, you can be flummoxed faster than that with the weather. Yeah. So it was a good experience. And then we got to Deception. Hey, Deception is kind of neat. And what had happened in the other place, ramming into all the ice, it kind of twanged the bow a bit, so we had a bit of a leak, so they beached the ship in Deception, which is all for great fun as well, you see, and they're busy trying to do something. Maybe they got some araldite, who the hell knows it. But
repairing the bows?
Huh?
Repairing the bows.
Yeah, they were doing something to repair the bows, yes. They didn't have araldite in those days, but they had a bunch of stuff. Because the thing is, they were a little concerned, because the year before, they'd blooming ripped the side out of the damn thing. So they were. So anyway, we got... fair amount of time there, so we got to go ashore. And I went ashore, and I can't remember his name, I went ashore with another guy. We went and visited the Argentinians, you know, spent a night there. It was great fun. Well, the other thing that happened was that they had these barges on the shore. And the barges were full of boxes, you see. Mm-hmm. So we went in there, you see. And I says, oh, well, that's in these boxes. You know, I'm taking the boxes out and opening it up. And inside there's these two big tins about a foot square, you see. So we open the tin up, and it's got this black powder in. I says, this is the guy, I says, I forget what his name is. I says,
Hey,
that's gunpowder. So, of course, oh, what are we going to do, you see? So I said, okay, fine, you see. So I get a handful of gunpowder and I'm laying a trail a la Bugs Bunny, you see? So I'm about 8 feet away, thinking I'm going to get another handful, turn round, and this other guy has got a match. I'm going, oh, I'm just going to say something, and he drops the bloody match into the... There's this big flash. I thought it was going to explode, but it's a big flash, and he's turning round, his anorak catches fire, and he gets knocked down, you see. And I goes up to him, you okay? Yeah, oh, okay, good, you see. And then I hear this... Just next to it, about 20 feet away, there's like a shed, you see. And there's this shout from the other side of the shed, you see. All this cursing and swearing. We go around there, and the second mate is taking a shit around the other side of the shed. And I said, boy, that must have helped. He said, help like hell.
Well, where did this gunpowder come from? What was it?
Well, it's left over from the whalers.
Oh, right. So you found it, effectively.
Yeah, we got all this. We did the next trick, you see. How are we going to set the... You know, it's gunpowder. You have to set it off.
You want an explosion, don't you?
Yeah. You betcha. So we worked it out, you see. I says, tell you what we do. We go to the base and borrow a rifle. So we borrowed a rifle and we put a box by a nice cliff there. Bang. Boom. Oh, great. You see? So I think we got up to about four boxes. And one of the guys, one of the seamen comes up to us and says, Captain would like to talk to you. So we ended up in front of the captain and he said, I would prefer you don't do that. In other words, you do that again and you're off my bloody ship. So we said, okay, sorry, sir.
What was his reasoning?
He thought it was dangerous. I mean, he didn't like explosions near his ship. I can understand that. But, as far as I'm concerned, we were just having fun. But, he decided that it wasn't safe. So and I think he was also concerned we might blow ourselves up. So...
Whilst we're at reception, there's another story concerning a scow and a digger.
Oh, well, that was funny too. I was going to go on to that.
Yeah.
Like I say, I'm a physicist and I look at things and I kind of try to work things out. But at the same time, I'm a young guy and I think, well, you know, I don't really know anything about this stuff, you see. But anyway, we stood there and they had this tractor, you know, a caterpillar tractor, you see. And they decided they wanted to take this from the base onto the ship. So they got the scow, you see. And the scow is kind of like a big empty box that floats, you see. So they put a couple of boards on the top, you see. And I thought, well, this is going to be fun. I don't think it's going to be able to get up there. Well, I was wrong there. It got up. It went slowly up, you see. Got to the top, and they put these two boards on the top, you see. And I thought... I don't think that's going to work. That's definitely not, I don't think, going to work. Anyway, they get to the top, but they must know what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So they get to the top, and they got this guy who was driving it. He was a bit of a character. He got a deerstalker hat and a bloody pipe, so he was like Sherlock Holmes. Why he wanted to be like Sherlock Holmes, I don't know. He got like Sherlock Holmes. He's up there. When he gets to the top, he gets into the middle of this thing. He's going real slow, you know, a quarter of a mile an hour. He's really creeping along, you see. But when he stops, then what happens is the inertia that he's got carries on. And in any case, he got over the centre line. So the whole thing just peeled over like this, real slow.
Forwards
into the sea. The whole thing lifted up on this side, went down into the sea with him. On top, going just classic diving position with his hands together. I thought, I hope he's all right. Well, he was all right. He kind of got himself out. The water isn't quite so cold there because that beach is volcanic, so it's not freezing cold. It ain't very warm, mind you, but so he came out. He got his pipe, but I think he'd lost his hat. And he was irritated about losing his hat.
Did they recover the digger?
They recovered the digger later, I believe, yes. Yeah, they didn't recover it while we were there, but they recovered it later. Maybe they waited till the tide went out. I don't know, but they did actually recover it, I'm told, yeah.
Let's go back to Port LaCroix. We were talking about climbing.
Yeah.
Particularly with John Cunningham in your second season, which would be 1960.
Yeah.
Did he have any first ascents? Or
had the first ascent, but people... We climbed at Wall Mountain, which I thought was the first ascent, but maybe it wasn't. Who the hell knows? But
That was another
kind of interesting experience, because we went up the glacier and we were climbing up the the wall side of the mountain. And you don't know what it's like in the Antarctic and that sort of situation. When I say it's quiet, it's bloody quiet. There was typically you get some wind. This particular day was a beautiful day. The sun was out, it was great. And there was no wind. It was absolutely quiet. Anyway, we get about halfway up. My sister John says, "Do you hear that?" He says, "Yeah." I says, "Sounds like an outboard motor. How the hell can there be an outboard motor up here?" So anyway, loud noise gets louder, and there's a blooming plane coming along below us. You know, at a lower level than us. We're waving like hell, of course, they never saw us. That must be the plane from Deception, which they finally got out. They had a hell of a lot of problem with that, you see. They finally got out, and they were taking it down to Base F, Argentine Island, you see. I says, "Oh, there's a plane. How about that, eh?" Fancy us seeing that. Of course, they'd chosen a great day. I mean, they had a hell of a lot of problems with that plane, because they had the plane at Deception, and they built a... like a shed.
A hangar.
Mm. Beg your pardon, a shed. They built the shed the wrong way round. So what it amounts to is every time it snowed, there was a big pile of snow built up. And, of course, you get a snowdrift there, you get a snowdrift. And they had to dig the damn thing out every time. Anyway, to continue the litany of disasters, what happened was this plane went down to the Argentine island. It landed on the ice. And as he came to a stop, he ended up on a soft spot. One of the skis went through the ice. The pilot got out, jumped down on the ice and walked ashore, and the boat and the aeroplane just sank through the ice. Nobody had told him there was a soft spot there.
I mean, that went on, that had quite serious implications for that season's work, because they were down to one plane. We said, therefore, really couldn't do anything with.
Well, they were down to one plane, and then they lost that one, because what happened to is they came into the John Bisco, which we used to call the John Bisto, and I think the Protector came in at the same time into Port La Croix and went a little close and sheared the bloody wing off of it. So that kind of got rid of all their bloody aeroplane antics, I believe.
Meanwhile, we were talking about climbing. But were there other significant, memorable climbs that you did, with or without John Cunningham?
Well, yeah, I mean, most of the climbs I did were with John, and we did some nice climbs. Climbing with John was great. John was a good guy. He really was a nice guy. The thing is that I was told that he was a member of this famous famous Glasgow climbing club, the Craig Dhu, and they were known in the climbing world as hard men. Well, and people, I mean, I remember reading in the Bass magazine, someone was saying what happened to this dog Peso, and you know, John had him put down or something. I said, you know, John was the softest-hearted guy you'd ever meet. He was a real nice guy. And, you know, he really liked the dog. You know, we'd go, what it amounts to is we'd set out from the base and we'd go off to go for a climb. We climbed up Javet. Javet, is it Javet? I don't know.
Javet.
Javis. We climbed up that a couple of times. And one time we went up there and we were going up the ice fall. And the dog's following us. And I says, we've got to go. I says, don't worry about the dog. I says, the dog's fine. I says, the dog will get to a stage where he can't go any further. Because I know dogs. He'll sort of whine a bit, and then she'll go back. And we come back down, and the dog will be bloody fine when we get back to base, which is true. But he was really worried about that. He said, maybe we should go. I said, no, don't you go back to the blasted base, because it's a long way. So the other time we climbed up there was the first time And what happened was, we set out in the boat, and we went across the bay to the glacier opposite. And we climbed up the glacier, and went up, and climbed up, there's like a pinnacle at one side of Jabbok. We climbed up that, and then we're climbing up to get to the top. And we're getting close to the top, and I says, wind's changed. Okay, wind's changed. I says, we've got to go back, John. He says, well, we're almost there. I says, no, we've got to go back. He says, why? I says, we've got to go back. You'll find out. We've got to go back. See, so we went back, we went down, we got down the glacier, and by this time the ice is starting to come in. And we used to slide down the glacier. I'll say down that paper. Got in the boat, we got about three quarters of the way back, and the ice like that, see? He says, oh, okay, now I can see why we had to get back. He says, what do we do now? I says, what we do now is we get out and we manhole the boat over the blasted ice floes, which we did, and I think we got one or two guys from the base came out to give us a hand. But, you know, it's hard work because those boats are about 400 pounds, so they took a bit of pulling over the ice. I don't think we had the right one either because there was two of them. There was a one that had a prow. Just trying to remember the name of the other type. There's another type of dinghy that's got a what's it at the front?
A scow?
No, it's not a scow. Geez, I can't remember these names anymore. But there's one that's kind of got a... the bow is kind of... goes up a pram. No, it's not a pram. I can't remember. Anyway, it's got a bow that goes up like that, so it's easy to pull onto the ice. So anyway, we got home, you see, and he says, yeah, I can see now why you turn around. And said, turn around. I said, yeah. It's another time, him and I, we went out, we had a small pram dinghy, and we went out to this glacier, to this, there was an iceberg out in the bay, and I said, we go out there. So we went out to this iceberg, and this was about the first time I did him in the boat, you see, and he's there, he's saying, he's really worried, because he could see the he says, what happens if the waves get big enough to get in the boat? I said, they don't get big enough to get in the boat. But he was worried about that. Mm. So we went out to this iceberg and we did a bit of ice climbing on the iceberg. But the thing is, you're not too enthusiastic because, you know, if you slip in into the sea, that seems bloody cold, mate, I tell you.
Did you get to the top of the iceberg?
No, we didn't, no.
So somebody pulled out. Did John pull out?
Well, we both pulled out. We both said, you know, that's it. We did a bit of climbing and said, well, that's kind of fun. Yeah, we get back in the boat. John was a climber and he was a mountaineer, but he was not as comfortable in water as I was.
Hmm. Was he the sort of man not to take risks?
Fun?
Was he the sort of man not to take risks?
He was the sort of guy who was prepared to take risks, like I was. He was the sort of guy who was prepared to take risks if you understood the risks. And he didn't understand the risk with water, and he was not comfortable with the water. I must confess, I wasn't real comfortable. I didn't want to get in the bloody water either, for that matter, so...
He later was working with the Outward Bound movement, wasn't he?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Did the news of his death reach you?
It didn't, no. It wasn't until a few years ago, I was looking on the web and I read that he was climbing some mountain. And I thought, well, I guess he died with his boots on, which probably pleased him as much as anybody's death pleases them. Mm. I don't know. I don't know whether he ever got married or anything like that. But he was, like I say, he was a good guy. The other thing that we did all sorts of stuff. But the other thing that we did, John and I, was one day, I don't know when you, I'm sure, I think it's maybe in the diary, but one day I says, you know, I think that the Neumayer Triad, Neumayer, is frozen right over. I says, you know, let's go and see how far we... So we walked all the way across. Mm. Well, we didn't go all the way across because we didn't, you know, we got ice cliffs over there. Well, we walked within, you know, maybe 50 or 100 yards of the other side and back. And, you know, realizing later that, boy, this was kind of a dangerous thing to do because the ice, it wasn't really frozen over. It was just brash that was all frozen together, but it wasn't really frozen over in the normal manner. And, you know, I don't think it very rarely froze over because there's such a strong current in the channel there. Mm. So, but we managed the other side and back. The back is important.
Skiing? Any skiing?
Skiing. We did quite a bit of skiing. Yes, I mean John was an expert at skiing, and the other guy who was an expert was George Lewis. I mean, George, when we went down there, George was full of the fact that he'd got these super head skis. Austrian, I think they were, but these super metal head skis, and he was enthusiastic about that. I'd never skied before, but you know, okay, we'll have a go at it, and I actually got quite good at it. Hmm. Basically, when you're there, when you get out onto the glacier, that's what you do. I mean, you have to use skis, because otherwise, if you're not careful, you go down a blasted hole. So you need the skis.
Is that how you broke your wrist?
Yeah, skiing. Yes. Yeah.
What happened? Because apart from that, you had a fairly accident-free period.
Yeah, I was skiing and I can't remember. I was skiing down the slope, just in the back of the base there by the Penguin Rookery, and I guess I fell, and my wrist got caught in the ski pole, and it hurt, and then I can tell you more about that, because it was painful, and so we got on the radio to the base F, where they got a doctor, and he said, oh yeah, he said, you broke this little bone in your wrist, a scaphoid. He said, it happens all the time, you see. He says, you know, if it hurts, he says, yeah, just, this is a universal remedy, you know, a wee dram and a couple of aspirins would. But a wee dram and a couple of aspirins, well, what it amounts to is, maybe 10 years ago, I was playing with my grandchildren. We're young girls, they were teenagers at that point, you see. And we went somewhere or other, and they had roller skates. So I put the roller skates on and fell and hurt me out, wristed. So then I went to the doctors, and they x-rayed it. And they said, well, it's funny, you've got all these broken bones in your wrist, but they ain't the ones causing the problem. But you've got a crack in the, I think it's the ulna, you see. I says, well, I broke them years ago, skiing in the Antarctic. And I'm the sort of guy who is not very happy about this. So what they did was they put a cast on, you see. And I said, okay, come back in 3 weeks, you see. So I had this cast on. And, you know, casts drive you crazy, drive me crazy anyway. So after about a week or so, I said, well, okay. I went back, and they said, oh, yeah, it's healing fine, you see. And I said, healing fine, yeah, kind of sounds good. So I went back to the shop and just cut the damn thing off. I said, that's it, it's out of here. but they said, we can't do anything about the other little bits. I said, well, okay, well, I guess we'll leave them there then. That's why it won't bend as good as the other one.
Let's pause, Paul.
Sure.
When we reconvene, I need to talk to you more about Port Lockroy and your work.
But okay, sure.
Let's take a break.